Welcome, cultists. As a great man once said, darkness falls across the land, the midnight hour is close at hand. That's right, we're now in week 3 of Silver Screen's Month of Monsters, which means that the 31st is getting very close now, when that veil between worlds is at its thinnest. Samhain, when the barriers are down between the real and the unreal, with the dead looking in. No, I'm not going all Conal Cochran on you, dear listener. That episode was last year's Halloween special. Besides, if I can make life-size replicas of Stacey and Elkin, the last thing I would be doing is concocting a maniacal plan to kill thousands with their own masks, believe you me. No, instead, this time around, we're going the more subdued route. We're relaxing with a good book. Well, a good comic book, as we flip through the pages of the George Romero, Stephen King anthology Creepshow. Yes, so far this month we've faced kaiju and cosmic horror. Now it's the turn of the more traditional horror. But the very first anthology here on Cult Classics, with not one, but several tales of darkness. Join us, won't you? I'm DK, I'll be the creep, insert joke here, that accompanies you on this little journey through the horrific as we discuss such terrors as zombies, bugs, alien plant life, and the disco dancing skills of Ed Harris. Fear not, though, dear listener. As usual, I'll not be alone. As always, I'm joined by a plucky young explorer of the unknown, who'll be the voice of reason and critical analysis for this one. And yet again, we have another newcomer to the show, and I've been trying to get him into the show for a while now. He's a writer, photographer, actor, and designer. Oof, I'm tired just reading that. It's John Adams. Welcome, John.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Not a problem. How are things going for you?
Great. Great. I'm very excited about this. I really appreciate you asking me to come aboard for this.
No worries. Am I right in thinking this is your first time doing one of these things?
I've done, yeah, I guess so. I mean, I've done interviews. Well, I did a podcast for X-Files for a little while. But yeah, this is the first time I've discussed a film or anything.
Cool. Well, not to worry. I mean, it's fairly simple, and just by the fact that I've been doing it for so long, it's obviously very foolproof. Do you care to fill the listeners in a little on your good self?
Oh, sure. I am, as you said, an actor, an artist, a writer, editor. I was an editor and writer for 25 years for several national publications in the U.S., and then I lived in Washington, D.C. and worked for an international trade association where I was the editorial director there. And then I was fortunate. I was able to leave that and move into a freelance career and then started working with art, digital art. It's kind of taken over most of my time now. I've done a lot of writing over the years, interviewed lots of celebrities. I worked kind of peripherally in the movie and TV industry where I did a lot of writing. Nice. So that's a little bit about me. I don't know if that's helpful at all.
No, that's fine. With regards to your art, I mean, I've been a fan for a while. Just to tell the listeners, back in my article writing days, my pieces were often accompanied on many occasions by John's artwork. Now, John's movie collages are truly some great bits of art, not only on his own page, but if you've been a follower of our Silver Screen Facebook group, you'll have seen John's work for yourself. And if not, if you've not part of the group, I urge you to go and check that out, as well as his own page, Phoenix Photography. So I've got to ask you, John, what prompted you to start these art projects?
It's really interesting. It's COVID.
Oh, right.
I had never been much of an artist when it comes to being able to physically draw. And my mother and my twin brother were very artistically inclined and were always drawing. But I didn't have that. You know, I was the writer and the reader in the family. But when COVID came and there was the lockdown, I had started doing some small digital promotional pieces for local theaters. You know, just in my spare time, I was kind of teaching myself to do that. And I knew I had an artistic sense from the ability of being able to create a narrative with pictures that already existed, but in a new way, which I call collage homage. So I just, I started playing around with the idea of doing that, and I'm not sure why, but I decided to give myself a project to do all 79, well, 80, if you consider the original opening episodes of Star Trek. I was going to do, all 79 since we were in lockdown, and I did, and it took a year and a half. So it started with that, and then developed into doing film work. And other TV shows. I did Frasier stuff, and but then I found, obviously Star Trek, there's so much of a fan community that as I developed that work after COVID, I was really, really fortunate that I started doing some work on Picard, Star Trek Picard. And it kind of came to the attention of Terry Metalis, who I don't know if you know who Terry is,
Oh
but Terry's
yeah,
in.
I'm a big Trek fan, so I know I don't.
Okay, so Terry started seeing my work and sent me a message or two. And then I interviewed Dave Blass, who is the production designer on Picard. And so I had done for a website, I had done a long interview with Dave Blass, and we really developed a nice little relationship. And so as I started doing Picard artwork, he and Terry and some of the cast have reached out, and we've communicated multiple times. And I've sent Terry a couple, well, at least one piece to his house.
Oh, wow.
So that's been a really surprising turn of events. I've been a Star Trek fan since I was six. So to now feel like I'm kind of, I'm not part of the family, clearly, but it's interesting to feel like I'm part of the situation in the Star Trek world, even if it's small.
And you take commissions, right?
I do, yeah.
Nice one.
Do a lot of commission work.
Well, in order to find out more about John's artwork, please check out his Phoenix Photography social media page. I'll put the link in the description. And to celebrate this episode of Cult Classics, John has put together a special Creepshow piece, which can again be found on his site. And I believe that, like all your other collages, prints are for sale. Is that right, John?
They are 8x10 pieces. They're available as canvases or as prints. And prints start at $50.
So yeah, please do check out that stunning bit of artwork on John's site, as well as all his others. I mean, the image on screen here, just it doesn't do it justice. So yeah, and if I've not said it to you before, thank you for putting that together, John. One last question I would like to ask, and the regular listeners will know this tradition by now, is we ask all of our first time guests on the show their all time favorite cult movie. It gives us like a little glimpse into your personality. So, if you had to choose just one cult favorite movie of any genre, a desert island dish, so to speak, what would that movie be and why?
Oh, you threw me. The first thing that pops into my head for some reason is Repo Man.
Oh, nice.
I don't even know why that popped into my head, to be honest with you.
Yeah, that's oh crikey, that brings back some memories. That's the first
I
time
know.
any of our guests have mentioned that. We might cover that at some point because it's a good movie.
It
So,
is a good movie.
any particular reason why you like that one?
I think, it was that age. If I had to guess off the top of my head, I'm not looking at anything. It probably came out in like, I don't know, like 83 or 84, something like that. So that was high school for me. I worked at a video store, so we loved movies. And that was out at the time. Of course, science fictiony, but also funny and quirky and weird. So probably
Nice.
it just ticked all the boxes probably for me as a teenager.
Yeah, so some movies do that. You kind of catch them at the right time and they stick with you.
It's true.
So yeah, now I'm going to get to the movie itself. Yeah, for those of you out there that aren't familiar with this one, and if not, why are you even here? Go watch it. Shoo, shoo.
That's right.
Creepshow, it's a 1982 American horror comedy anthology film directed by George A. Romero and written by Stephen King. The film's cast includes Hal Holbrook, Adrian Barbeau, Fritz Weaver, Leslie Nielsen, Keri Knight, E.G. Marshall, Vivica Lindfors, Ted Danson and Ed Harris, as well as King himself. The film was primarily shot on location in Pittsburgh and its suburbs. Now, it consists of five short stories: Father's Day, The Lonesome Death of Jordy Verrill, based on the King short story Weeds, Something to Tide You Over, The Crate, and They're Creeping Up on You. Now, two of these stories were adapted from King's stories themselves, with the film bookended the prologue and epilogue scenes featuring a very young boy named Billy, who is played by King's son Joe, who some may now know to be his pen name Joe Hill. He's punished by his abusive father, the awesomeness that is the Tom Atkins, for reading horror comics. Now, the movie itself is an homage to the EC horror comics of the 50s, such as Tales from the Crypt, The Vault of Horror, and Haunt of Fear. In order for the film to give viewers a comic book feel, Romero hired longtime effects specialist Tom Savini to replicate the comic-like effects. Now, the movie was given a four-week test release in Boston in July 82 to give Warners a sense of how to market it, with the results convincing Warner Brothers that they had a hit on their hands. It went into general release on Wednesday, November the 10th, 82, and immediately went to number one at the box office, dethroning Stallone's First Blood and earning $21 million in the US alone, making it the highest-grossing horror film for Warner Brothers that year. Although it was a reasonably modest hit at the box office, critics were divided on the movie. Roger Ebert gave the film 3 out of 4 stars and wrote, "Romero and King have approached this movie with humour and affection, as well as with an appreciation of the macabre." While Gary Arnold, in his review for the Washington Post, wrote, "What one confronts in Creepshow is five consistently stale, derivative horror vignettes of various lengths and defects." Nevertheless, despite this lukewarm critical reception, the movie has developed a cult following over the years and currently holds a 66% approval rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Not that that really matters these days. And in 2007, Bravo awarded it the 99th spot on their The 100 Scariest Horror Movie Moments. Once again, this is DK reminding you to remember, kids, critics aren't the be-all and end-all of the sign of a movie's quality. Yes, I am aware of the irony. As always, the movie can currently be found on various streaming platforms, as always, dependent on your location, as well as in physical formats of DVD and Blu-ray. So if you haven't seen it, come on, guys, you've got no excuse by this point. Now, this one was a complete surprise to me. It was, I believe, a Christmas gift from my parents back in the day. Yeah, I'm once again showing my age here, but VHS was all the rage, and studios at that point were releasing their back catalogues onto the format to generate some revenue. Knowing I was a horror fan, they picked it up on the spur of the moment, thinking it would be the kind of fun thing I'd be into, and yeah, they were right. Yeah, I've got a great affection for this one, whether it reminds me of those times or of the movie's quality in general. And I've owned it in, I guess, one format or another ever since. So how about you, John? Have you got any standout memories of the first time you saw this one?
Oh, you know, it's funny because I was not, when I was younger, I wasn't into the horror genre. And I hadn't, at that point, seen any George Romero classic. And I remember this was a mainstay on HBO when HBO first began. This would have been like right after it came out, probably the year after it came out. It would have been what, like 83 or 4 when it came out on VHS and when it came out on HBO. My God, they played it on a loop, and I probably watched it every time it was on. And it actually, it's funny because it actually got me to start reading Stephen King. And my gosh, then I started reading all of the books. And I didn't appreciate, you know, I was a teenager. So I liked it for all the, you know, the craziness. And it holds up though really, really well. And, you know, of course, I watched it recently to prepare for this. And I was really surprised at how much I still like enjoyed it in a different way, a more mature way. It just really fun, and it's actually pretty moving in some places. my first experience is just watching it a million times on HBO.
Nice one. Well, yeah, I mean, you mentioned it was moving in parts, and that nicely segues into the writing of this one. It was King's screenwriting debut, and weirdly enough, it's the only, you know, this line is jumping ahead to the direction, but it is George Romero's one of the only films where he didn't write the screenplay, but it's the only George Romero film to open up at number one at the weekend box office. So it obviously had something, and I think there's I don't know what you think yourself, but I think there's some really good writing in this.
There's some really good writing, actually. And that's what surprised me when I watched it again. In almost all of the segments, there is something really, a real nugget of great writing. You've got really great, fun actors who are jumping 100% into it, which is surprising when you see somebody like Hal Holbrook, who he's actually one of my favorite character actors. I've seen every Hal Holbrook film multiple times. And you know, you think of him as like a more, you know, serious actor, a little more gravitas, and yet he's totally into this.
He seems to have his tongue firmly embedded in his cheek during this, and I love that.
Oh, I do too. And you know, the whole idea of, you know, they're kind of who's afraid of Virginia Woolf, you know, the famous play and film. And it's really kind of he and Adrian Barbeau are playing those characters.
Yeah, it's very Martha and George, isn't it?
Yes, it's George and Martha. You know, it really is. It's he's the professor, and she's crass and embarrassing and awful. And but this takes it to a different conclusion.
Yeah, it's I really like it, and I think one of the good things about it is the anthology never kind of settles into, you know, a kind of rote, stereotypical, you know, you've got this, they're not the same kind of story at all. I'm not sure how many stories they would have gone through during the selection process, but each one has an individual kind of flavor. And I think that's the best thing when it comes to anthologies. You look at some of the other ones that have come down the pipeline since, and they never quite hold up. But I think this has got a nice little variety to it.
I think that the idea of the comic book, which is what ties all of the stories together, obviously, I think that makes a huge difference in this case, because it's such a strong and graphic connection. You've got all of the artwork that's so fantastic throughout, that keeps you moving from one chapter of the comic book to the next. You know, anthology films, as you know, almost never. This is actually one of the few that actually made money. And I think a lot of it is because it had a really strong base concept that they were able to really, really use well through each story.
It is, as you say, a very good, very novel at the time framing device. Although I will say, you mentioned, you know, with regards to King, at the movie's beginning, when the boy's father is, you know, giving him a telling off for reading this comic, and the boy comes back with, you know, saying it's no worse than what's in the porno magazines that his father has. I just think it's amusing because King got his start writing those short horror stories in porno magazines.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, I love little meta touches like that in these kind of movies. So that's with the Kingisms, you know, like in the Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill, you see the sign at the end for Castle Rock. There's always
which I love.
Yeah, there's always some nice little Easter eggs in there. But it's weird. I didn't realize it. I've watched it so many times over the years. I'll be completely honest, and you know, this is probably going to have people turning off in disgust, but I never really picked up any of the old EC horror comics. So,
well, no, you know what? Neither did I.
Yeah, I can't say how close they are, as an homage it is, but it wasn't until this time watching it, and maybe, you know, I was just completely devoid of thought during the other times that I've watched it, but this is mostly bad people doing really shitty things to each other. There's not one, and I'm guessing maybe Geordie Verrill in the second one, there's not one who there's not one who exemplifies a traditional protagonist role. They almost represent the seven deadly sins to some extent. You know, you've got wrath, you've got greed, you've got envy, and you watch it and there's nobody to root for as such. I mean, even though you kind of root for Hal Holbrook in The Crate, you feel bad for doing it. I don't know what your thoughts were on that.
You know, well, you know what I think? I think it's set up so that you know who you root for is Creepshow Skeleton.
he's just doing his job.
You know, he's the one that's kind of telling, you know, he's telling you each tale, and, you know, they all get what they deserve in each tale. He's kind of the Rod Serling of the comics, you know?
Yeah. Because it wasn't until this time I'm watching it and I'm thinking, okay, you're kind of supposed to root for the family, kind of, but they're all vapid, selfish people. And one of them actually murdered the guy, no matter how much of an asshole he was. Geordie is pretty much just greed exemplified. In Something to Tide You Over, you've got Leslie Nielsen, who's just a shit. But then there's Ted Danson, who, you know, and the woman who was cheating on him, regardless of the fact that it was a loveless marriage. You go over to The Crate, and, you know, we've already discussed the problems with that one. And then you go to They're Creeping Up on You, and E.G. Marshall is just a bastard. So, you know, it's weird that you can't end up rooting for the cockroaches.
But you know what? I think that's indicative of early Stephen King. You know, the creature is not necessarily the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's these awful humans.
Yes.
Who get what they deserve.
Yeah. It is kind of an interesting little twist on the protagonist-antagonist role, and I do like that. And, you know, you, without trying to read too much into it, because at the end of the day, it is a horror comedy, but you do come away at some point thinking, am I a git for, you know, for wanting that, you know, for wanting that person to come out on top? It does play with a kind of moral centre. And yes, you could say that the bad people get what's coming to them. But everybody kind of gets what's coming to them, even if, you know, by our standards, they're not necessarily bad. The one that I feel most sorry for is poor old Geordie, played by King himself.
I know. You know what? I found the end of that particular story always really upsets me.
Yeah.
I find it really sad and awful. You know, in a good way. Because it's so tragic. It's so tragic. And it's like, please, God, just let me be able to aim and, you know, blow my head off. That's always impacted me like, oh, my God, it's just, oh, it's so horrible.
Yeah. It's that scene immediately prior to that one that starts getting to me, where he sees that vision of his father in the mirror.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, I'm a goner now, no matter what. You instantly start feeling sorry for him. So when it does come to that, you know, when he pulls the rifle, oh, God, it's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking because, you know, he's just off. He's just completely smothered by it. It's always really upset me in a way that I wouldn't expect in a movie like this, where, you know, it's silly and it's scary, and yet it's also touching in that moment. It's like, oh, God, this is horrible. Poor Geordie.
It kind of makes you feel guilty because up until that point, you're laughing at the guy.
I know.
And then it takes such a turn, and you come away from that one thinking, well, shit. And then they drop that line in the news broadcast at the end where it says, you know, this summer's going to be the greenest that you've ever seen. And it kind of makes you laugh again. But you still come away from it. Yeah, it's a weird one.
It just brings another level to the movie. It makes it better than the average anthology because you've got this great writing.
Definitely. It kind of brings us to the acting itself. And yes, you do get people chewing the scenery in this, but there is some really good performances as well. Yeah, when you look at, you know, the usual sort of thing for these movies, you know, they're usually low budget and they have actors and, you know, the actors are doing the best job that they can with the writing. I mean, it does help that it's King's writing on this, but there is a quality to a lot of the acting in this.
No, I love Fritz Weaver, and, you know, he's so, he completely loses his mind in this, and I just love him.
You know, I mentioned it earlier that Hal Holbrook's got his tongue in his cheek, but when he's playing it, calculating, you know, when he's figuring out what to do with regards to, you know, his significant other and how he's going to dispose of her and stuff like that, it is really good. He sells you on it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I did read, as I said, I couldn't find out how they managed to get so many good actors in. The only thing that I could find was on a couple of the actors themselves, and it's the majority. It's from Something to Tide You Over. Leslie Nielsen, who we all know, you know, mostly now from a million and one parodies. I mean, I think he does a good kind of performance as the evil mob boss, as it were.
He's a great bastard.
Yeah. But apparently he had that little fart machine in his pocket during the shooting.
He'd
continually let it go off during rehearsals and just before Romero would call action, which would cause Ted Danson and the crew to crack up with laughter. So I can... No idea what Romero thought of him by the end, but...
Well, you know, he did that on all his films.
Yeah.
Years.
I can remember when he...
fart machine.
There was a TV talk show over here, Terry Wogan, and he had Leslie Nielsen on for an interview at one point, and Leslie Nielsen was just continually used that little fart gag throughout the interview, and the interviewer was just cracking up by the end. another thing I've got to point out, which I thought was kind of mean, Ted Danson, he said in a TV interview that his daughter was on the set during the scene where his character returns from the dead. He purposely tried avoiding his daughter out of fear of scaring her and giving her nightmares. Finally, despite his best efforts, she went up to him, looked at him, and simply said, "Oh, hi, Dad."
Kids never react the way you want them to.
No.
I think that's great.
So, yeah, it's a shame that a lot of modern audiences won't really appreciate, I don't think, unless they're well-versed in the cinema of that time, the caliber of actor that's in it. And I think that's a real shame because it is a standout for me in this movie.
I'm trying to think if I agree with that or not. You know, sometimes it's difficult because when you've seen a movie when it originally came out, it's sometimes hard to separate how a modern audience views it because you still view it from that lens of being in the 80s. So I would love to see it. I really think people would like it. I actually wonder, with the way things have gone technology-wise, if we won't see some sort of a return to perhaps an anthology film. I would think now, with attention spans and going from, you know, Instagram to TikTok to Facebook to whatever, I would almost think that an audience today would be more geared towards an anthology type of film.
Well, the one thing that does, I'm not sure if you've seen it, the Creepshow TV series that Shudder started.
I never watched it.
We had Shudder for a little while, so we saw most of the first season, and a lot of it was pretty decent. It kind of captured that feeling. And again, he had some decent actors in it. So I do urge you to check that out if this is your kind of thing.
I will. You know, I was just thinking to that again, just reiterate about why this movie particularly works and maybe other anthologies don't. They were really able, and this is Stephen King and George A. Romero, they were really able to capture how a teenager reading comic book it's that whole world of comic books, teenager. It's funny, it's horrible, you know, but it's the tone of the movie is so perfect, you know. And I think when we're talking about other anthologies that just don't work,
No. You know,
you just, between the acting and there needs to be a tie, a really some sort of important tie that really works. And this just has it all, you know. It has humor, it's horrifying, you know, there's some pathos in it. The special effects are, you know, perfect. You know, I mean, it's a comic book. It's great. It really is a comic book.
With it being an anthology, I mean, I'm jumping ahead now, especially one with a comedy angle. You don't expect such good direction, but with it being Romero, you know, when you look at the framing, such as the one, we're going back to Lonesome Death of Geordie Verrill again, when the doctor's holding the cleaver, telling Geordie it's going to be extremely painful, the way that shot's set up, it's beautiful. And
oh, yeah.
And then later on in Something to Tide You Over, when the, for want of a better word, the underwater zombies, when they break into the apartment, you're seeing them walk around, but... And then it keeps cutting to the security cameras, and all there is on the security cameras is the mist. It's done really well. I mean, not to mention those uses of comic book panels and captions. It really does,
oh, yeah,
to me, show how good a director Romero is. I mean, he's known for his dead movies. And this, it's kind of like almost like a footnote in his career. But I think Creepshow, it's a brilliant showcase for his talents. He brings, you know, that again, that different flavour to each one of the tales, as well as the bookends. And for a single director, it's really impressive work.
You know, I think that's a really good point, and I hadn't really thought about that. And actually, when you think about that, a lot of other anthology films have different directors for each story.
Yeah.
Not always, but I'm thinking of Twilight Zone, the movie, off the top of my head. And so you're right. So there's even more going on with him directing each of these, creating a different, you know, environment, and also some amazing shots. You know, it may be his best film, directing-wise.
Yeah. I never really thought about it that way. I mean, I
didn't either, but when you think about it, it's almost like, you know, he's taken everything that he has learned and put everything into this one film in each of the segments.
And it never gets stale, as it were.
No, it doesn't. And he does great, interesting shots. Of course, you've also got, you know, it's a comic book, so he also has a lot of shots that you would see in a comic book.
Yeah.
What's great is they were both 150% in.
Definitely.
He and Stephen King. You know,
oh, yeah.
They were good friends. They'd wanted to do a film together, and you can tell that they just had a ball doing.
Oh yeah, for sure. And when you look at it, I think everyone on the crew had that kind of, it has that energy about it where it looks like everybody that took part had a genuinely good time. I think you can pick up
you can
on that
really
vibe
feel
sometimes.
That you yeah. really can feel that, can't you? Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. This one, again, it just kind of goes a long way towards, again, making this kind of an anthology movie work.
I mean,
I feel like I'm sitting and reading a comic book and reading each of the stories.
Definitely. I mean, you never lose that verisimilitude. It gets the premise, it sticks with the premise, and not at any point do you think that they've just abandoned it or done some, you know, gone in another direction just for convenience's sake. And it even carries over into, say, the little Easter eggs in the animated section where it's flipping through the comic book and you have the adverts for those, you know, those old style comic books where you could send away for X-ray specs and things like that. They don't
yeah,
do
see,
any...
I love that. I love that because all those little ads are in there.
Yeah, they don't do that anymore. And I used to love looking at those ads when I was a kid. Your imagination would run wild. But yeah, I do love those little Easter eggs. I mean, one of the ones that I did notice in the crate, Hal shoots Adrienne with a 44 Magnum, the same one that he takes away from Harry in Magnum Force. I love stuff like that.
You know what,
these little Easter eggs.
You know what I know now. You know what I know. I'm a huge fan. My favorite John Carpenter film is The Thing. But what you gotta love is the crate is from Antarctica Research Station, and the name on it is Carpenter.
Oh, I noticed where it was, but I didn't notice the Carpenter name.
Yes, brilliant. Yes. So John Carpenter has sent the thing to them from, you know, Antarctica, which I think is just, talk about a fun little.
Oh, that's
such
that.
A great. Yes, when I was rewatching it, because I knew it said Antarctica, and I kind of chuckled. But then when I saw that the name on it says Carpenter, I was like, oh, this is great. I love these little moments. And, you know, he was married to Adrienne Barbeau at the time.
Yes, yeah. Weirdly enough, according to special effects artist Tom Savini, when Fluffy breaks out of the crate once it's dumped in the quarry at the end,
oh yeah, mm-hmm.
The remains of Adrienne Barbeau were supposed to float out, but apparently deleted that. Whether it was for the sensors.
That would have been good.
Yeah. It was, from what I can gather, the first fully animatronic creature Tom Savini ever created. He spent over an hour and a half, apparently, on the phone with Rob Bottin, who, as you know, was the effects artist from The Thing, getting advice on how to build it. So, yeah, it kind of... Maybe that's one of the reasons why it was labelled as such.
That's just so great.
To me, personally, I don't know what your thoughts are, but that holds up incredibly well.
That story or the effect?
Both. Both. I don't think the story would work if the effects came across looking so poor. I mean, it's Savini, so obviously they're going to look great. But I think that one in particular still holds up really well.
Oh, it's terrifying. You completely still understand why Fritz Weaver completely goes marbles. He loses his marbles, you know. He's like, you know what he reminded me of? He reminded me of John Lithgow losing it in Twilight Zone, the movie. Where he has he's just completely raving because he's...
Yes.
Because that thing is terrifying. It's really scary. It's great.
So, yeah, with regards to the other effects, Stephen King apparently had an allergic reaction to the makeup. Yeah, so he had to be subjected to shots and medication just so the makeup would be bearable. Although during a break in filming, he took his son Joe, or, you know, as we mentioned, he was in the bookends. He took him to a McDonald's, and as a joke, he had Savini make him up with bruises and cuts and stuff. And the girl at the drive-thru window ended up calling the police.
Oh, no! No!
Whoops. Yeah.
Well, and talk about, there's another actor who we see a lot playing the father.
Yep, good old Tom Atkins. We spent a good hour last Halloween special on Cult Classics just discussing Tom Atkins and how awesome his mustache is. in fact, it was because I'd not watched Creepshow in a while and we put it on, I was actually disappointed that he was clean shaven. I'm ready for some Atkins mustache action. And,
no, that is disappointing. Oh, yeah, man.
So, weirdly enough, as we're, you know, we're talking about effects, Romero said during Fan Expo Canada, I think it was 2015, yeah, he said that the cockroaches, I mean, bearing in mind the cast, we've already gone on to the cast, but he said the cockroaches were the most expensive part of the movie. Yeah, they were 50 cents a piece. And they used more than 250,000 of them, which came to a grand total of $125,000 just on cockroaches. They were partially provided by the American Museum of Natural History. Apparently to fill them out, especially in that scene at the end, you know, where they all burst out of Pratt, they were filled in with various boxes of nuts and raisins.
Oh, that's interesting.
But I don't know about you, because I saw this probably at such a young age, it kind of traumatized me for life. Especially if I see any bugs on TV or anything like that while I'm eating, I cannot eat.
Oh, wow.
Just, I think it's just because of that section where he suspects something in the cereal and he goes and looks in the mixer.
Yes!
That's traumatized me for life.
Isn't that, well, my God, I don't know what to say about that, sorry.
Yeah.
Ugh.
That and the skull on Father's Day are the only, to me, effects that have dated slightly. But it is only slightly. I mean, when I'm a big I'm a big advocate for physical effects, physical special effects rather than CG. And when you look at the work of Tom Savini in, you know, obviously Romero's other movies and in this, all right, his acting's not that great in this. But when you look at, you know, his effects work, it's in a grotesque way, just beautiful.
Oh, it is. It's great. So do you have a favorite, favorite effect? And it doesn't matter, you know, what practical effect in this movie.
In this movie, it's going to be a toss-up between either Fluffy or, I would say, the underwater zombies. When Nielsen tries shooting the underwater zombies, and he's shooting it in the head, and the blood and the water
and the bullet hole.
You just think, oh, that's just chef's kiss. People are probably going to listen to this, and, you know, if they're not horror things, and think, demented bastards.
Yes, it is wonderful, though. It's like, nom, 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 nom.
Yeah, it is. I just think it looks great. What about you?
Just for silliness, I guess, the head with the candles on it.
Oh, the cake.
At the end of Father's Day. He finally got his cake.
Yeah.
I love the cake. I don't know why. I love the cake. I love the candles that are lit on the cake. It's a super easy special effect. You know, there's nothing to it. I just think it's great.
And it's pretty iconic for this movie. Whenever you, whenever you put Creepshow into a search engine, that's one of the first images that comes up from the movie.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we've mentioned the acting and the writing, directing and such, the effects. I'm going to ask, what do you think to the sound design on this?
It's fine. I love the little musical interludes.
Yeah.
I think those all, again, play right into the comic book theme. I think the general soundtrack for the stories themselves is pretty generic.
Oh, really? I love it.
Yeah. Really?
It's going off on a tangent here. It's John Harrison, and I think it's a wonderfully creepy soundtrack. I used to own this one on vinyl, simply because when I was younger, I was obsessed with Romero's Day of the Dead. And I tried getting the soundtrack, and they only released the soundtrack for a little while, and then it was incredibly... I mean, obviously, we didn't have internet like we do now, so it was really hard to get hold of, so I just had to make do with the next best thing, which was John Harrison's soundtrack for this. I used to listen to this and Bernstein's Nightmare on Elm Street soundtrack.
While other
parents' kids were in their teens and listening to music of the time, I was listening to this and Elm Street, and my parents were extremely worried.
You know what I was listening to?
Go on.
I was listening to this. I was constantly listening to... I had the album for Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Oh, James Horner. Brilliant soundtrack.
James Horner soundtrack, which, you know, I wore out, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I could see where your parents could be like, how about some rock music or something?
Get listening to some rap. Please be normal.
Please.
Yeah, I think they thought there was, you know, there was a serial killer... fermenting.
The theme of my life.
Yeah.
now I have to say I feel like I was flippant in saying that. I need to give it another I need to give it a listen, a serious listen.
If I mean I'll point out, I think the two standout parts for me, the section where Leslie Nielsen's character drives off and leaves Ted Danson on the beach, that's one.
Yeah.
And then the opening scene of the crate where it drops and rolls towards the underside of the stairs. The music, the chords in that, I just think are beautifully haunting. So yeah, honestly,
I need to give that another try.
Yeah, honestly, if you could get hold of the soundtrack, the soundtrack on its own, listen to it, because again, with the same as the stories and the same as the directing, he manages to imbue the different ones with a kind of different vibe, as it were, but there's still a little motif that runs throughout. And I think I honestly think John Harrison's a really underrated composer when it comes to scores.
I was going to ask you, because I don't know who John Harrison is, other than, so can you give me some other soundtracks that he has done that I might know?
John Harrison, honestly, the best one I can tell you, because I just love it wholeheartedly, is the soundtrack for Romero's Day of the Dead. Absolutely fantastic. It's got like a kind of Caribbean vibe running through it, but it's so impactful. If you've not watched it in a while, I urge you to watch Day of the Dead again, because this, I think the soundtrack from that movie, it makes that movie.
Okay, I need to do that.
I've got to ask, before we go any further, do you have any favorite story or story out of this anthology?
Oh, I don't want to be boring and say The Crate, but I am going to be boring and say The Crate.
Yes, that's all right. I'm going to be as boring as you and say the same.
It's got everything. It has humor. The acting is great. Everybody in it's good. It's a very long, it's probably the longest story, isn't it?
It is. It clocks in around, I think, 40 minutes, that one.
Really?
Yeah, but it is worth it. I honestly do think it's the best one. I mean, just coming in behind it for me, is that Something to Tide You Over, which I really like. But yeah,
I love that one too, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to have
People
to be.
Forget that Leslie Nielsen, you know, earlier in his career, was a dramatic actor.
Yeah.
And a lot of people forget that. And so when he does do dramatic stuff, you know, he's very much like his character in Nuts, the Barbara Streisand film. He's, you know, really, he's a dangerous guy. And he's scary when he gets angry. He plays that really well. You know, he's menacing. He's really menacing.
Yeah.
You know, and he does that very well.
I think people
forget.
Exactly, yeah. I think they look at his parody work and think he was a kind of a one-trick pony, and he really wasn't.
No, I mean, I go all the way back. I know it's in my top five favorite films is Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the leading man. He was the captain of the ship, and he was. And people forget.
Yeah. Well, mention going back to what you were saying earlier, this was one of the only successful anthology movies. I mean, the success of this, it started a kind of small cycle of copycat films in the early 80s, such as, you know, Cat's Eye, Twilight Zone, the movie. Yeah, I mean, there'd been some cartoon anthologies before, you know, like things like Heavy Metal, but this was the only unqualified success out of the entire bunch. And it was adapted, you know, sometimes you'll get a novelization of a movie, that kind of thing. Normally Alan Dean Foster, but this one was, it was adapted into an actual comic book. And Bernie Wrightson, who was known for his work on Heavy Metal, and he was influenced himself by the 1950s EC comics. He did the artwork and is the uncredited writer. I managed to track down a copy of that, and it is really good. So if you do get a chance, it's worth a read.
I absolutely would love to see that. Wow, yeah. That's great. I didn't even know that. That's wonderful.
Get yourself an Amazon straight up. I hope it's still available, but yeah.
I will look.
So, yeah, I mean, as legacy goes, they did a Creepshow 2. They were going to do a Creepshow 3, but apparently there were rights issues at that point. So Tales from the Dark Side, the movie, was the unofficial Creepshow 3. They couldn't apparently just couldn't use the title. There was a Creepshow 3 release, but it had nothing to do with King or Romero, and to all intents and purposes, everybody just treats it as utter garbage.
Yeah.
But again, there was a Creepshow TV series produced by Greg Nicotero, and it streamed on Shudder. Yeah, I think it's had 4 seasons so far. And
Universe, it's still on?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm saying that from a thing of now. I'm not sure if it's still there or if it's on the bubble or if it's been cancelled and the news just hasn't reached
me
yet.
But I didn't realize it was so current.
Yeah, I honestly check it out. There's some really good stuff in there. And then on August 3rd, 2019, Universal Destinations announced that Creepshow would be coming to Halloween Horror Nights. The maze featured 3 segments from the 1982 movie, as well as 2 others from the TV show. And apparently the world's largest collection of original Creepshow memorabilia belongs to the Creepshow Museum, located on Facebook and in Louisiana. So, yeah.
I don't mean to laugh, but that's just so random.
It is. Yeah, I that's why I put it in. I just thought, that's...
Oh, now so, I need to know why.
I want to go, and not to the Facebook
one. I do too.
So yeah, now I mean, normally the movies we look at here, with a couple of notable exceptions, they don't do particularly well either at the box office or critically. This one didn't do too bad. So when it comes to Creepshow, would you personally label it a cult classic, or do you think it's a did you just think it's a decent film that's held up over the years, bearing in mind it doesn't get much of a mention in the mainstream?
No, it's absolutely a cult classic.
Well, we're in agreement on that.
200%. It's not a film that everybody knows. It doesn't, just because a film is moderately successful doesn't necessarily knock it out of the cult status, I don't think. This is definitely a cult classic.
Nice one. When it comes to this, is there anything particular that resonates with you? I mean, have you got a particular element that's just chef's kiss? And I mean, that could be anything, a line, a particular performance, technical aspect, anything. What does it for you?
It's that moment with Hal.
All right. The get it to call you Billy.
He says, just get it to call you Billy. I just think is so Stephen King and George Romero. Because it's horrific, it's hysterical in like a scary way, and it's also really, really funny.
Cool. As much as I love Romero's direction, I've got to give this one, and you're going to think I'm banging on the same drum, but I honestly think John Harrison's score is the thing that does it for me on this. It switches motifs at the drop of the hat. And the 2 best stories, Tide and Crate, and to me personally, they're on another level with that soundtrack. So, yeah, definitely, give it a re-listen and see what you think.
I will, and I think we should say for everybody out there, give it a listen if you can find it. This is great. I'm gonna look this up immediately.
Nice one. So, that's us so far. So what do you out there think, listeners? As usual, we asked you on our socials for your opinions on this one. So we'll go over to the good lady, Vianne, to hear what you had to say. Vianne, what have you got for us this time around?
Hey, DK. So, yeah, anthology horror has a special place in my heart. I think there's something to be said for short format horror storytelling. And I think oftentimes it's the best way to have, to instill fear in an audience. Things left unseen and unsaid. So I really do love this format. And of all of the anthology films, I really think Creepshow 1 and 2 do a spectacular job. And it looks like a lot of our audience agrees with me. Matt Mann says, Creepshow 1 and 2 were great. The third was shit and shouldn't have been made. And that's usually the case. And these are my words. That's usually the case in a series. Trevor Storr, I absolutely adore the first 2 Creepshow movies. They were anthology horror at its best. Agreed. Casey Martz has a really cool image of a penguin giving 5 stars. Vincent Raven Jr., classic. If you lived around here where I live, you'll see Creepshow on a daily basis and on weekends, nightly basis. Haha. Matt Toledo, 5. No second thoughts whatsoever. Desmond Root Ambrose, 5 stars. Jason May, it's one of my all-time favorites, entertaining from beginning to end, and easy five. Mark Newman, Creepshow 2 scared me silly, that thing on the lake as a kid. Mark, I agree, not that it's scary, but The Raft is definitely one of my favorite short stories from the Creepshow anthologies. In fact, just recently I had a friend over and we were talking about it. I'm like, oh, you haven't seen The Raft? And I just pulled up that specific one on YouTube. So that's kind of fresh in my mind. What an interesting story that was. Let's see, what else? Kiefer Kelly. Yeah, cheesy in some contexts is great. Correct. Ty Deggs. Young Ted Danson. Scary. Ha ha. Phyllis Pleasance. This is great. Love the crate, but love most of them. Crate is awesome, of course. Frank Roman. Top-notch 80s horror. Ed Ortiz. Stories by Stephen King. Directed by George Romero. Special effects by Tom Savini. Tom Atkins. Adrian Barbeau. Leslie Nielsen. And Joe Hill. King's Son. Probably the best 80s horror anthology movie. David King again. 5 out of 5, one of the finest horror films ever made. Yeah, I have to say, also, as a side note, somebody, as someone who suffers from misophonia, the episode or the short story with the cockroach infestation was really interesting to me. Was that more misophonia or OCD is a question, but anyway, still a fabulous story, but I think my personal faves, definitely The Raft from Creepshow 2, and I like the beach one, and oh gosh, they're all good. It's such a great movie, and so much fun year-round, not just at Halloween. You know, there's a space every day for horror, and then, you know, we could get into the discussion of horror versus terror, but maybe that's a discussion for a different day. So with that, back to you, DK.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you once again, Vianne. And we'll hopefully hear from you again soon. And thank you to you out there, too, for taking the time out to let us know your thoughts. And if you forgot or just didn't get them in on time, then you're always welcome to get involved in the comments on this episode or on the aforementioned socials. We're always listening, and links, as usual, are in the description. Which brings us to our final thoughts here in the studio. As always, we'll give our roundup of what we think and our score out of 5, which will give us at the end our final score. So, John, do you want to kick us off for this one? What ultimately do you have to say about Creepshow, and what would you give it out of 5?
Creepshow, the perfect mid-80s Stephen King, George Romero, horror anthology. I mean, it's just, there's nothing like it. There's nothing as well done as this one. It brings you all of the flavor of George Romero and Stephen King at really their best, both of them at their best, and really firing on all cylinders, loving every moment of it. I give it a 4 out of 5 because I think it's really, really well done and holds up so well. And also makes me feel like the 80s again.
Well, that's always good.
What about you?
Well, I mean, you'll have to bear in mind, because I went on a bit of a long-winded rant on this one, but yeah, it's an odd duck, this. I mean, I can't comment on how it is stateside, but over on this side of the pond, despite the name being instantly recognisable, it's not that well-known a movie. And certainly not a well-known Romero movie to wider audiences, which to me is a shame, as it's great fun. As with all anthologies, there are some standouts and some not-so-standout tales, but hand on heart, I can honestly say there's not a single dud in this. And it's simply down to, I think, personal preference on which you personally find appealing. Romero shows just how good a director he can be. He brings a different style to each story. Performances are great, with some, you know, really great scenery chewing going on, as is expected for a comic book movie, with some actors stepping outside of their comfort zone, or at least the audience's comfort zone. The King screenplay is, as you'd expect, a terrific little porthole into the Master of Horror's mind, with some stories that are still, to me, still edge-of-your-seat stuff, despite the humour, and it treads that line really well. And it's topped off with that, you know, brilliant score by Harrison. So yeah, it's a good one. I will say that some of it hasn't aged particularly well. I mean, it's been It's been 40 years now, and the sandwich is starting to curl at the edges a little. The sight of Ed Harris disco dancing is enough to scare some people to death alone.
I agree with that. Yeah, that's kind of scary. That's probably might be the scariest segment of the film.
Yeah, that O face he makes. Oh dear.
We could all do without that.
Yeah. Add into the mix that there is no truly likable protagonist in this. Everyone is an utter shit to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. So you sometimes question who to root for. Having said that, it is still tremendous fun. Perfect viewing for a Halloween evening. So with that, I'm going to give this one 3.5 out of 5. Which
I said 3.5.
So, yeah, averaging out both our scores, it gives Creepshow 1982 a final cult classic score of 3.75 out of 5. So, yeah, I mean, does that seem reasonable to you?
It does. It seems fair.
Nice one.
I can live with that.
Yeah, I think it's a nice little compromise. I mean, it's one of those that seems to be largely overlooked. Most horror fans are familiar with it, or at least the odd scene, but it's always left out when someone cooks up a best horror movies list. So, you know, hopefully we've gone one step towards showing some much needed love to this one.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that's a good idea. We need to do that. And you're right. It doesn't get any real notice.
Yeah. So once again, that's it for us. I want to thank you out there once more for joining us on this one and hope you've enjoyed it. I also want to give a big thank you to our guest for joining us on this one. So, John, thank you for finally taking that chance and jumping in on it with us.
Thank you so much. I've had so much fun.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you come back if given the opportunity?
I would love to come back.
Oh, good stuff. So where can the listeners find you if they'd like to check out your work? Any socials you have where they can find you, or any upcoming projects you'd like to mention?
Thank you. You can see my art. If you want to find me on Instagram, it's under writer, WRITER 41, and Facebook at John Adams/Phoenix Photography. And come visit. I would love it.
Awesome. So yeah, if you want to find either of John's socials, we'll also put the links in the description. So yeah, you should be able to find him, as we put the links to all our socials. So again, join us on there if you're so inclined. I would especially recommend the Silver Screen Facebook group if you'd like to get in on the discussion. And if you like what you heard this time around, then please like, subscribe, and spread the word to friends and family. And if you didn't like what you heard, then by all means, share it with someone you consider your personal nemesis. Everybody's welcome here. We will be back sooner than regular, heading into week 4 of our Month of Monsters, as we take a look at a different type of monster, the Quiet Boy Next Door. Well, that is next door if you're staying at a certain motel. That's right, Cult Classics will be crossing over with Mike's Cinema Classics next time, as we register at Bates's for a look at the Hitchcock classic Psycho. Come on, you knew it was only a matter of time. It's in the titles, for goodness sake. Until then, keep working on that Halloween costume. Get those Samhain sacrifices ready. And remember, I can hold my breath for a long time.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by TK. Produced by Mike Wilson. Editing by Nick. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.